Ladies and gentlemen, welcome George Wallace. Okay.
Well, that's a great introduction. You know, I had an argument with my banker son-in-law about the word deconstruction. He rejected that notion entirely. He's in Essex, and he made me defend the proposition of deconstruction. So I'm glad you supported that I was in there. You know, I want to just once again, before I give this presentation, thank the people that have put this together and making it happen. Lidbury is a fabulous festival. I really have seen anything like this anywhere I've ever been. And, of course, Chloe and Philip have a lot to do. Martin, one of the founders of this program 19 years ago. But it's the people in the back. It's Sandra and Polly, and it says four kids who are always walking up and down the street, Sam and Harry and Raya and Christina, and people, the volunteers that are doing such great work. This is kind of like when John Foster Dulles forgot to mention Korea, and then there was a Korean War. You don't want to leave somebody out. And, of course, the people who are very generously putting me up at their house right now, and, you know, in the back, Allison and Nigel, thank you very much. It's been a beautiful thing. And I have to get in the train station at 9:48, if that's possible. Good. Right, so I'm pleased to be able to represent the Wilt Woman Birthplace as the writer in residence here in Lidbury. I've been there since 2011. And you know, Walt Whitman is a huge presence in the literary landscape of America, especially having grown up within spitting distance of his house. You know, it's in the shadow of Walt Whitman that my own writing emerged, just like as a Long Island boy, it's in the shadow of New York City that my identity emerged. So, I mean, there's a lot of shadows to come out from under. I don't know if it's like that here with John Masefield at all, but, you know, if there's shadows like that. But that's something that I had to face, that somebody like Neely Tchaikovsky, who is from Brooklyn and now lives out in San Francisco, never did. So he was able to write a whole book called Whitman's Wild Children about people who are influenced by Whitman and whose work reflects something about his method or his message. And that's something that he didn't have to do, but I did. So, but that's what I want to do for you today, is having been there for a couple of years, talk a little bit about the origins and the character of Whitman's method first, and then his message as well, and what you can see, some of the influences and some of the places that came from. Because, you know, not being a very good student, this is not a scholarly thing, by the way, this is just sort of an observational thing by underground street poet, as Martin characterized me. There's things that I'm going to tell you about that are my observations and my feelings and expressions of my relationship with Whitman as it emerged, because a lot of people don't know where this guy's voice comes from, that somehow his voice and his type of poetry sprang out of the head of 19th century America like some goddess and just emerged from, and where did it come from? It was a spontaneous thing, or maybe it was an alien abduction. I don't know what people think, but they don't understand, and they try to identify how Walt Whitman could have this very different sort of approach to writing and have a vision and a kind of statement to make, which was in some ways at odds with a lot of what was happening, especially in the early Victorian. But it turns out that you can find the places that his voice came from, the methods that he used. And Whitman had an incredible ability to write a particular kind of oratorical flourish. It has anaphora in it. It has front-loaded rhythms that propel you forward in a declamatory way. And these are things that emerged not from the study of poetry so much as it came from his work as a reporter in New York City, where he would cover the events, the orators of the day, the politicians and the speech makers, and he would listen to the rhythm of their speech. He also would hang out down at the Five Towns. If you've ever seen the movie Gangs in New York, with the Irish and rough gangs in New York City, he would hang out with those guys, and he was picking up a lot of street lingo from those guys. So they picked up these things very specifically from locations and cobbled it together into a voice that he would use for his own kind of writing. So that's something about the method, and I'll give you a couple of examples of people that he sounds a whole lot like from his own era. And then the message, which, you know, is essentially is a transcendental message. It's about the human condition, the individual and the collective, and the divine spark. And this is a guy whose father, or his mother's side, was the Van Velsers, were Quakers. So he was picking up a lot of ideas from the Quaker movement in America. And to this day, I mean, I've been up to Swarthmore Hall, and I've seen where Quakerism got started, that place where George Fox rode across the salt marshes or whatever, that little firth of Morecambe Bay, you know, to come across to meet with Margaret Fell. Margaret Fell, or somebody knows? Yeah, Margaret Fell. You know, and so I've seen that place where that happens. As a matter of fact, they just had a rescue there just yesterday, I think. Two guys were on Folly Island and trying to walk across when the tide was coming in. It's one of those tidal basins rushing across, but that didn't stop old George Fox. So anyway, you know, that's where it got started. And we have Quaker locations around Long Island. And this was part of the ideas that Wilton was picking up on. And Quakerism, of course, isn't the only place that the divine spark and the dignity of man comes from, because if you think about the Romantic Revolution, and if you're like me and fell asleep during the class where they talked about Romantic era and thought that it's like romance novels, but it's not. It's actually about dignity of man. It's about the human condition. It's about the idea that all men are created equal. It's the idea that life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, the things that are in the Declaration of Independence, the things that are in the French Revolution, for better or for worse, the things that are in Chapter 7 of Wordsworth's Prelude, where he talks about going into the city and having come back from France and hating so much about the city, but there's an underlying greatness. If you just strip it away, you can see the underlying greatness. These are ideas of the Romantic era revolution, which emerged in a different way in America in the transcendental writings. So these are the things I'm going to give you some examples of. And just to show you that it's not something that was just back then, it's got nothing to do with anything, I'm also going to give you some examples through a reading of people whose writings, from Woody Guthrie to Allen Ginsberg to Nick Alexander, who's here in this town, although he's going to see the Grateful Dead today, or something about the Grateful Dead and work. So listen, just an aside, all of you who came here instead of going to see what Nick has gone to see about the Grateful Dead, thank you so much for coming. And I'll tell you this, you know, in 1959, when they were making a decision whether or not to purchase the Walt Whitman birthplace and preserve it, there's letters to the editor saying, why would you want to save Walt Whitman's birthplace? The guy was lazy. He was risque. You know, you may as well want to save Elvis Presley's house. So that connection is still there. So anyway, here is just to show you how sometimes the method and the message is in what people are writing today. This is a poster which was printed by Martin Clark at the Tilly's Press by Nick Alexander from this town. Just this year, 2015, it's called Alley Cats. We're laughing alley cats. We're a bright-eyed tribe. We slap rats to mice and fur flies to... what am I saying here? To our nine lives. And fur flies to our nine lives. We dance along the wall. We're cats who like the great groove. We click and finger pop. We drum, flick knives on the roofs. Mongrels with a mission, we get the sharpest claws. A streetwise coalition, we roll on rainbow paws. Nick Alexander, 2015. Now I'm going to go right from that to Walt Whitman. Tell me if you don't feel sort of the same kind of rhythm that's going on there. This is Walt Whitman giving a salute to the world. It's called Salut au Monde. What do you see, Walt Whitman? Writes Walt Whitman, of course. Talking to himself, I see all the menials of the earth laboring. I see all the prisoners in the prisons. I see the detective human bodies of the earth, the blind, the deaf and dumb, idiots, hunchbacks, lunatics, pirates, thieves, betrayers, murderers, slave makers of the earth, the helpless infants and the helpless old men and women. I see male and female everywhere. I see the serene brotherhood of philosophers. I see ranks, colors, barbarism, civilizations, and I go among them. I mix indiscriminately, and I salute all the inhabitants of the earth. You, whoever you are, all you continentals of Asia, Africa, Europe, Australia, indifferent of place, all you on the numberless islands of the archipelagos of the sea, and you of centuries hence, when you listen to me, and you each and everywhere whom I specify not or just include just the same, health to you, goodwill to you all from me and America sent, each of us inevitable, each of us limitless, each of us with his or her right upon the earth, each of us allowed the eternal purports of the earth, each of us here as divinely as any is here. Toward you all, in America's name, I raise high the perpendicular hand. You get the front-loading, the rhythm, the repetition, the listing, all these things of what women's about. This is Allen Ginsberg in a Wells visitation. He wrote it in 1967 in the Brecon Hills. Pretty close to here, Brecon Hills, about 40 miles, 50 miles from here. You know, he went on a TV show, and William Buckley was prepared to just slice and dice him. But when he read this poem, Buckley's face fell, and he goes, "This guy's legit." And so this is when Ginsberg was first recognized by, you know, conservative idiot like Buckley as being a person who really has more than just being a wild, crazy, beatnik, whatever, but a person with philosophy and craft. Telling naught but what is seen by one man in a vale in Albion's 160 miles from London's symmetrical Thorn Tower, what did I notice? Particulars. The vision of the great one is myriad. White fog lifting and falling on mountain brow, trees moving in rivers of wind. The clouds arise as on a wave, gigantic eddy lifting mist above teeming. Ferns exquisitely swaying along a green crag, a glimpse through mullioned glass in valley rain. All the valley quivered, one extended motion, wind undulating on mossy hills, a giant wash that sank white fog delicately down red runnels on the mountainside, tapping gigantic through Lanthony Valley, the length of all England, a valley upon valley under heaven's ocean tunned with cloud hang, heaven balanced on a grass blade. Oh, fall on the ground. O great wetness, O mother, no harm on your body. Stare close, no imperfection in the grass. Each flower, Buddha eye, repeating the story, myriad formed. Kneel before the foxglove, raising green buds. Mauve bells dropped and drooped and doubled down the stem, trembling antennae. And look in the eyes of the branded lambs that stare, breathing stock still under dripping hawthorn. I lay down, mixing my beard with the wet hair of the mountainside, smelling the brown vagina, moist ground, harmless, tasting the violet thistle hair sweetness. The great secret is no secret. Senses fit the wind. Visible is visible. Rain mist curtains wave through the bearded veil, cross-legged on a rock in dusk rain. One being, so balanced, so vast, that its softest breath moves every flower set in the stillness on the valley floor, lifts trees on their roots, a great earth heart calling our presence together. So where's this voice come from? Whitman himself, you know, he wrote a series of memoirs that was collected called November Bells, talks about the orders that he paid attention to. People, there's a guy named Father Taylor who he prays for his latent volcanic passion. He talks at length in November Bows about abolitionist speechmakers, Elias Hicks, the Quaker, Daniel Webster, Cassius Clay, not Muhammad Ali, but the first Cassius Clay, and followed by Edward Everett. So here's a couple of their voices, just to give you a sense for what the oratory of the day was. And remember, there was no television, there was no internet, there was no radio or anything like that. So there was, back in the 19th century, this was big. Speech-making, oratory, was really not only just a way to get it, communicate ideas and to try to convince the public, but it was a form of entertainment, so it's big. This is Father Taylor at a temperance speech in 1843. Rum! Here it is, and in the great Athens of America, too, where the church spires, as they point upward, are almost as thick as the masts of the shipping along the wharves. All the machinery of the drunkard-making, soul-destroying business is in perfect order, from the low grog holes on the dock to the great establishments in Stillhouse Square, kept open to ruin my poor sailor boys. And your wives and daughters, as they walk to church on Sunday, do often brush the very skirts of their silk dresses against the mouths of open grog shops that gape by the way, and your poorhouses are full, and your courts and prisons are filled with the victims of this infernal rum traffic, and the hearts of your wives and mothers are full of sorrow. I say that with all deference to the Prince of Wales, which is a great place to go. Daniel Webster declaiming before the United States Senate in 1850. Let us make our generation one of the strangest and brightest links in that golden chain which is destined to grapple the people of all the states of this Constitution for ages to come. We have a great popular constitutional government guarded by law and defended by the affections of the whole people. No monarchical throne presses these states together. No iron chain of military power encircles them. They live and stand under a government popular in its form, representative in its character, founded upon principles of equality, et cetera, et cetera. So you get the sense that they're doing the same sort of thing. It's listing things going on. They're using a particular sort of parallelism, which, you know, you're supposed to learn in the 10th grade how to construct sentences correctly so that they follow each other. And the use of parallelism is really brilliant by these guys. Here's Edward Everett, and I say guys advisedly because I'm going to be doing the woman who wrote Over the Rivers and Over the River and Through the Woods pretty soon. Here's Edward Everett. He's speaking of the unveiling of a telescope in Albany, New York in 1856. And this is all Whitman's era, by the way. For all the kindred and tribes and tongues of men, each upon their own meridians, from the Arctic pole to the equator, from the equator to the Antarctic pole, the eternal sun strikes 12 at noon and the glorious constellations, for up in the everlasting wilderness comes the tonics and barks which brace mankind. I believe in the forest. I've got it wrong. Because, you know, befriend of the skies, this is a telescope, befriend of the skies chimes 12 at midnight, 12 for the pale student over this flickering lamp, 12 amid the flaming glories of Orion's belt if he crosses the meridian at that fated hour, 12 by the weary couch of languishing humanity, 12 in the star-paved courts of the Empyrean, 12 for the heaving tides of the ocean, 12 for the weary arms of labor, 12 for the failing brain, 12 for the watching, waking, broken heart, and it goes on and on like that. You see the oratorical flourish, and that's just very much what he was doing. That one of the other thing I was just doing was, when I skipped a page, was Henry David Thoreau. You know, he's talking about taking a walk, which, you know, anybody wants to know how to take a walk, you know, you come to England to learn how to walk. I know that. 1861, Henry David Thoreau did a pretty good job about talking about it. Give me the ocean, he says, the desert or the wilderness. The west of it which I speak is but another name for the wild, and in the wildness is the preservation of the world. Every tree sends its fibers forth in search of the wild. The cities import it at any price. Men plow and sail for it. From the forest and wilderness come the tonics and barks which brace mankind. I believe in the forest and in the meadow and in the night in which the corn grows. Life consists with wildness. The most alive is the wildest, not yet subdued to man. Its presence refreshes him. One who pressed forward incessantly would always find himself in a new country. or wilderness and surrounded by the raw material of life. And Lydia Marie Child, who we all know, "Over the River and Through the Woods to Grandmother's House We Go." At least, I mean, every American knows that song. You know, that's the song. It's like Thanksgiving, and you go like you're going to go to the family Thanksgiving, you know, party. And even though, you know, my parents were from the city, and I was living in a suburb, rural area, I was like, I'm going to go over the river and through the woods to a farm where my parents and grandparents are. It was just the opposite at that point in time. This is the iconic idea, is that on Thanksgiving you go out into the country to some family place like that. And Lydia Marie Child, who wrote that song, also was an abolitionist and a publisher. And she writes about, up to Northampton, Massachusetts, about the experience of being in New York City. And very much like Wordsworth talking about the underlying greatness of things, she writes, "The noisy discord of the street cries give the ear no rest. The weak voice of weary childhood often makes the heart ache for the poor little wanderer, prolonging his task far into the night. Sometimes the harsh sounds are pleasantly varied by some feminine voice proclaiming its musical cadence, 'Hot corn, hot corn, buy my lily white corn.' There was a time when all these things would have passed by me, like the flitting figures of the magic lantern or the changing scenery of a theater, sufficient for the amusement of an hour. But now I have lost the power of looking merely on the surface. Everything seems to me to come from the infinite, to be filled with the infinite, to be tending towards the infinite." And I give you your own Charles Dickens, who Ripman wrote about in newspaper columns when he visited New York, describing Broadway and Lower Manhattan from his American Notes, 1842. "No stint of omnibuses here. Half a dozen have gone by within as many minutes. Plenty of hackney cabs and coaches, too. Gigs, phaetons, large-wheeled tilburies, private carriages, rather of a clumsy make, and not very different from the public vehicles, but built for the heavy roads beyond the city pavement. Coachmen in straw hats, black hats, white hats, glazed caps, fur caps, and coots of drab, black, brown, green, blue, nankeen, striped jean and linen, and there, in that one instance, looking while it passes, it'll be too late, in suits of livery. Heaven save the ladies, how they dress. We have seen more colors in these 10 minutes than we should have seen elsewhere in as many days. What wonderful various parasols, what rainbow silks and satins, what pinking of thick stockings and pinching of thin shoes and fluttering of ribbons and silk tassels and display of rich cloaks and gaudy hoods and linings." So you can see the milieu from which Walt Whitman was drawing this tone in his poems. Not from, you know, from the artifice of formal poetry, what we call formal poetry today, you know, rhyme, strong rhyme and rhythm, but this open, bold, declamatory sense and recognition of the magnificence and panoply of existence, and there's something that's sometimes overriding it in a very positive way, very positive sort of way. So that's something about where the voice comes from. Now, of course, you know, this high sense of wonder and the sense of connection and the sense of the infinite and the finite and the absolute and the particular is something that we hear, I mean, it's totally contemporary, whether you salute the divine in other people by saying namaste or, you know, study the Kabbalah and expression of the soul root, or George Fox says, "There's a light that's shining in the heart of a man," Sufi proverbs, William Blake saying, "If the doors of perception was cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is infinite." You know, Thoreau, "Read not the news, read the eternities." The guy who was the founder of the whole hippie movement in California used to sit up in the mountains by the Hollywood sign, Eden Abez. "We are all beings of heaven and earth, of thunder and lightning, of rain and wind and galaxies. Joni Mitchell, we're stardust, we're golden. We've got to get ourselves back to the garden." Ginsburg, "We're all beautiful sunflowers inside our wavy gravy," saying, "We are all the same person trying to shake hands with ourselves." You know, this is a message that's absolutely contemporary to us, and it goes back. It goes back. and Walt Whitman was giving utterance to it. Here's Walt Whitman talking about miracles. Why, who makes much of a miracle? As to me, I know of nothing else but miracles. Whether I walk the streets of Manhattan or dart my sight over the roofs of houses toward the sky or wade with naked feet along the beach just at the edge of the water or stand under trees in the woods or talk by day with anyone I love or sleep in a bed at night with anyone I love or sit at a table at dinner with my mother or look at strangers opposite me riding in the car or watch honeybees busy around a hive of a summer afternoon or animals feeding in the fields or birds or stars shining so quiet, so bright, or the exquisite, delicate, thin curve of the new moon in spring. Whether I go among those I like the best and that like me the best, mechanics, boatmen, farmers, savants, or the soiree, or to the opera, or stand a long while looking at the movements of machinery, or behold children at their sports, or the admirable sight of the perfect old man, or the perfect old woman, or the sick in hospitals, or the dead carried to burial, or my own eyes and figure in the glass. These, with the rest, one and all, are to me miracles. The whole referring, yet each distinct and in its place. To me, every hour of the light and dark is a miracle. Every cubic inch of space, a miracle. Every square yard of the surface of the earth is spread with the same. Every foot of the interior swarms with the same. Every spear of grass, the frames, limbs, organs of men and women, and all that concerns them, all these to me are unspeakably perfect miracles. To me, the sea, it's a continual miracle. The fishes that swim, the rocks, the mention of the motion of the waves, the ships with men in them. What stranger miracles are there? That's 150 years before LSD. Of course, I did mention, you know, George Fox, and Whitman writes about George Fox, the Quaker. He's of decent stock. George Fox was of decent stock, an ordinary lower stock, worked at the shoemaking, also at farm labors, went about from town to town, dressed in leather clothes, walked much at night, was illiterate, could just read and write, entered the courts and warned judges to see they do justice after sleeping out of doors or in hedges or haystacks, and though often dragged out and whipped till he faints away and lies like one dead, here when he comes to, he stands up again and cries out to his tormentors, strike, strike again, here where you have not yet touched. George Fox stands for something, a thought that wakes in silent hours, perhaps the deepest, most eternal thought in the human soul. This is the thought of God, merged in the thoughts of moral right and immortal identity. The range of his thought covered almost every important subject of after times: anti-slavery, women's rights, the foundations of the old, the superstitious, the conventionally poetic, the credulous, all breaking, and the light of the new and of science and democracy definitely beginning a mad, fierce, almost crazy age. And he's talking about George Fox. This is Ralph Waldo Emerson. Everybody talks, you know, that's the first person people go to say, where's this guy coming from? They go to Emerson. But Emerson talks about the concept of the oversoul, a great nature in which we rest as the earth lies in the soft arms of the atmosphere, is that unity, that oversoul, within which each man's particular being is contained and made one with all other. We live in succession and division, and parts and particles. Meantime, within man is the soul of the whole, the wise silence, the universal beauty to which every part and particle is equally related, the eternal one. And in this deep power in which we exist and whose beatitude is all accessible to us is not only self-sufficiency and perfection in every hour, but the act of seeing and the things seen and the seer and the spectacle, the subject and the object are all one. We see the world piece by piece as the sun, the moon, the animal, the tree, but the whole of which these are the shining parts is the soul. All goes to show that the soul in man is in an immensity not possessed and that cannot be possessed. From within or from behind, a light shines through us. upon things. It makes us aware that we're nothing, but the light is all. A lot of this actually, you know, it comes from Thomas Carlyle, the English author Thomas Carlyle, who was really the rage in for a short period of time in the 19th century in America. You know, there's a guy named George Constantine Christo. Because you can Google anything nowadays. I found George Christo did like a PhD about the relationship, thing on the relationship between Whitman and Thomas Carlyle. He says this, Unraveling Whitman is called. He argues that there's direct correlation between the two of them, not just in ideas but stylistic elements. The idea of the hero, prophet, and poet, which, you know, that does ring a little oddly with us today, but metaphorically he notes that to us also, through every star, through every blade of grass, is not a God made visible. This is Thomas Carlyle. In every blade of grass. And you heard Ginsberg mentioning the blades of grass, and of course Whitman's great work, Leaves of Grass. So there's this thing that runs through this, through every blade of grass is not a God made visible, if we will open our minds and our eyes. Here's the metaphor of clothing. Very interesting work that Carlyle did with this. Whatsoever sensibly exists, whatsoever represents spirit to spirit, is properly, it's a clothing. It's a suit of raiment. It's put on for a season to be laid off. Thus, in one pregnant subject of clothes, rightly understood, is included all that men have thought, dreamed, done, and been. The whole eternal, external universe and what it holds is but clothing. Space and time as spun and woven from us, for us from before birth itself, to clothe our celestial mate for dwelling here, and yet blind to it, all minor illusions in this phantasm existence weave and paint themselves in vain, while here on earth shall you endeavor to strip them off if you can at best, but rend them asunder for moments and look through. There's one other guy I just want to mention, and I'm going to give you some of the people that that are doing this that you'll hear from after, you know, from Carl Sandburg right up to through the Beats and some more, even more recent people. But I'll just mention John Ruskin. His idea, the sense of wonder, however great a man might be, said John Ruskin, however great a man may be, there are some subjects which ought to throw him off balance. Who's seen Big Lebowski? Yeah, Big Lebowski. The dude abides. Ram Dass says, this chopping of wood, carrying water, it's karma yoga. It's yoga of daily life. What you do because that's what the harmony of the universe requires. If I'm a potter, I make pots. But who is making the pots? I'm not under the illusion that I'm making the pots. Pots are. The potter is. I am a hollow bamboo, says Ram Dass. And this is from How to Walk Across a Parking Lot. Ease up on the gas. That's the first thing. If that first spot's your spot, you can take it with grace. Do so. Keep moving until you find one. There's a better spot farther away. When you park, turn off the ignition and pause for a moment. To pause is not to wait. It's to stop and pay attention. When it's time to walk across the parking lot, don't walk like anyone else. They don't want to be anywhere but walking across the parking lot. Millions of people live and die without ever suspecting the joy that can be had in the simple act of crossing a parking lot. Bask while you walk. Amble like you're walking in a bathrobe. It should feel like walking alongside a pool to the snack bar. And this movie, I'm sure many of you know it, American Beauty. This is that scene where the bag is dancing around, and the wind is pushing the dip, and the boy's explaining to the girl what it is, why he's filming this thing. He says, it was one of those winter days, a minute before it begins to snow. There was this electricity in the air. You could almost hear it. This bag was just dancing with me. Like a little kid, begging me to play with it for 15 minutes. That's the day I realized there's an entire life behind things. And this incredibly benevolent force wanted me to know there was no reason for me to be afraid, ever. It's like God is looking right at you for a second. And if you're careful, you can look right back. And what do you see? Beauty. So, that's 35 minutes. I want to leave a little time for question and answer if we have. Yeah, so I'm going to read some more recent examples. Carl Sandburg, you know, if you ever, people who are old enough to remember the Kennedy inauguration, and there was like a little poet with hair flopping around, and he was reading the poem. It was called Sandburg. He also wrote the introduction to a book called The Family of Man, and this is him talking about the universal and the particular. If the human face, Carl Sandburg says, is the masterpiece of God, it's here in 1,000 fateful registrations. Child faces of blossom smiles, mouths of hunger followed by homely faces or majesty carved and worn by love, prayer and hope, along with others light and carefree as thistle down in a late summer wind. Faces have land and sea in them, honest as the morning sun flooding a kitchen light. Faces crooked and lost in wondering, faces in crowds laughing and wind-blown leaf faces, profiles in an instant of agony, mouths in a dumb show, mockery lacking speech, faces of music and gay song or a twist of pain, a hate ready to kill, a calm and ready for death face, the strange and baffling eyes of youth. There's only one man in all the world, and his name is All Men. There is only one woman in the world, and her name is All Women. There's only one small child in the world, and the child's name is All Children. This is John Steinbeck. And you know, Grapes of Wrath, you know that scene at the end where Tom Joad is saying, you know, whether there's anybody being beat up by the cops, I'll be there. You know, that's that speech that he gives. And it sounds like it's like, you know, I'm gonna stand up for the oppressed, and I'm gonna fight for people. But in fact, if you read the context of it through the book, the idea that Tom Joad is trying to express at that point is that, you know, he's referring to some guy, some preacher back in Oklahoma who lost his faith and didn't realize what he was about, what he should be doing on earth, until he had a moment of recognition. And so Tom Joad gets his moment of recognition, you know, in the labor camps in California with the migrant laborers, and that's when he says this. So here's the full context of it, and then it'll make sense to you. This is in the first, like, in the first 10 chapters. There was the hills, says this guy. This preacher has lost his faith. And there was me. We wasn't no separate. We wasn't separate no more. We was one thing, and that one thing was holy. We was holy when it was one thing, and mankind was holy when it was one thing. When we're all working together, not one fella for himself or one fella for another fella, but one fella kind of harnessed to the whole shebang, that's right. That's right. That's holy, says Casey at the beginning of Grapes of Wrath. And at the end, Tom Joad says, Casey, he talked a lot. He used to bother me. Well, I've been thinking about what he said. I can remember all of it. He says, one time he went in the wilderness to find his own soul. And he found he didn't have no soul. That was his. He says he found it, just got a little piece of a great big soul. Says the wilderness ain't no good because his little piece of a soul wasn't no good unless it was with the rest of him and what was whole. And, well, I know the wind, Ma. I know the wind, and I know how a fella ain't no good alone. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fella. But woe to him that's alone when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. So I've been thinking about it was how it was in that government camp, how our folks all took care of themselves, all working together for our own thing. Well, maybe Casey was right. Maybe, like Casey says, a fella ain't got a soul of his own, but only a piece of a big one. And then it don't matter. Then it don't matter. Then I'll be around in the dark, and I'll be everywhere. Wherever you look, wherever there's a fight, so hungry the people can eat, I'll be there. Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. I'll be in the way guys yell when they're mad. I'll be in the way kids laugh when they're hungry and there know that their supper's ready. And when the people are eating the stuff that they raise and living in the houses that they build, why, I'll be there. One little wrinkle on this is the idea of the picaresque rogue saint. Kind of like an outsider who's, despite not being part of society, has this this beautiful innocence, redemptive innocence, because they're outsiders. You get that with Huck Finn. You know, Huck Finn's floating down the Mississippi River with a slave gem, and he's like, he's passed a note. They say, we know what you're up to. You're trying to get a slave out of here, right? And, you know, if you turn him in, you know, we'll let you go. So Huck Finn's on this raft deciding what he should do, whether he should turn Jim in and get off or not. Well, I felt good and all washed clean of sin for the first time I'd ever felt so. It's the first time I'd ever felt so in my life. I knowed I could pray now, but I didn't do it straight off. Laid the paper down, sat there thinking how good it was all this happened so. How near I come to being lost and going to hell, and went on thinking over our trip down the river, and I see Jim before me all the time, in that day and in the nighttime, sometimes moonlight, sometimes storms, and we are floating along, talking and singing and laughing. But somehow I couldn't seem to strike no places to harden me against Jim, only the other kind. I'd seen him standing on my watch on top of his, instead of calling me so I could go on sleeping. And see him, how glad he was when I come back out of the fog, and when I come to see him again in the swamp, up there where the feud was, and such like times. He would always call me honey, and pet me, and do everything he could think of for me. And how good he always was. And at last I struck the time that I saved him by telling the men we had smallpox aboard. He was so grateful. He was so grateful. I said, I was the best friend old Jim ever had in the world and the only one he's got now. And then I happened to look around and I seen that piece of paper. It was a close place. I took it up. I held it in my hand. I was trembling because I had to decide between two things. I knowed it. I studied a minute, sort of holding my breath, and then I said to myself, all right, then. I'll go to hell. And I tore it up. That's a great Woody Guthrie from Bound for Glory's biography, autobiography. Talking about drifting across states with a friend called Cisco, ending up in Seattle by the flats where the skids are. Skids for picking things up in the skids, right? That's where Skid Row comes from. And he's talking about, you know, going through the crowd and being an outsider, being a busker. Cisco and me sung for our chips. We moved along the skid, looking in at the bars and taverns, listening to neon signs sputter and crackling on the lookout for a gang of live ones. The old splotchy plate glass windows looked too dirty for the hard rain ever to wash clean. All doors and dumps and cubbyholes had a sickly pale color about them, and men and women, bosses and work hands humped around inside and talked back and forth to each other. Some soggy smelling newsstands tried to keep their fronts open and sell horse race tips and sheets to the people. They were ducking head in and out of the rain, in the rain, in the rain, and pool halls stunk to high heaven with tobacco smoke and spit and piles of dirty men yelling over their bets. And there was hawk shop windows all piled and hanging full of every article known to man, and hawked there by the men that needed them the most. There was tools, shovels, carpenter kits, paint sets. There was compasses, brass faucets, plumber's tools, saws, axes, big watches that hadn't run since the last war, and canvas tents and bedrolls taken from the fruit tramps. Coffee joints, slippery stool dives, cash counters with open fronts was lined with men swallowing, chewing, hoping that the rain soaked would wash something down from Skid Row, something like a job somewhere along the Skid Row, a job. Garbage along the street, stones and the curbing, there's a shale and the slush that washes down the hill from the nicer parts of town, the papers crumpled and rotten, the straw, the manure, the silt that comes down from the high places, like Cisco and me. We came down from the high places. We came down like several thousand rounders to land and to clog and to get caught along the Skid Row. This is where the working people come to squeeze a little fun and rest out of a buffalo nickel. These three or four blocks of old wobbling flop houses and buildings. I know the people I see here on the Skid. I know them. Had to pull down over their faces, I can't see. They know me, they know my name. They call me a guitar busker, a joint hopper. They call me a tip canary, a kitty box man. Movie people, horse wranglers, outsiders, honky-tonk, whiskey sitters, gin-soaked, comers, goers, good girls, bad girls, teasers, whores, busters, corn huskers, nice people, bastards, sons of bitches, fair, square, and honest folks, low, sneaky, greedy people, and somewhere in amongst all of these Skid Row skitters, Cisco and me, we sung for our chips. Toni Morrison from jazz. She talks about what happens when rural people come to live in the city. Oh, I'm crazy about this city. Daylight slants like a razor, cutting the buildings in half. In the top half, I see faces. It's not easy to tell which are people, which are the work of stonemasons. Below is shadow where any blasé thing can take place. Clarinets, lovemaking, fists, the voices of sorrowful women. A city like this one makes me dream tall and feel in on things. Hep, it's the bright steel rocking above the shade below that does it. When I look over strips of green grass lining the river at church steeples and into the cream and copper halls of apartment buildings, I'm strong. Alone, yeah, but top-notch, indestructible. Nobody says it's pretty here. Nobody says it's easy here. What it is decisive. If you pay attention to the street plans all laid out, the city can't hurt you. Breathing hurts in weather cold like this, but whatever the problems have been, winter bound in the city, you put up with them. Why? Because it is worth anything to be on Lenox Avenue, where the sidewalks, snow covered or not, are wider than the main roads of the towns where you were born, and perfectly ordinary people can stand at the stop, get on a streetcar, give the man a nickel, ride anywhere you please. Well, you don't please to go so many places, because everything is right there where you want it, right there, the church, the store, the party, the women, the men, the post box, no high schools, furniture store, the street newspaper vendors, bootleg houses, no banks, beauty parlors, barbershops, juke joints, ice wagons, rag collectors, pool halls, the open food markets, the numbers runners, and every club, organization, group, order, union, society, brotherhood, sisterhood, or association imaginable. It makes you wonderful just to see it. You could pop a cork and put the cold glass mouth right up to your own. Now, this is a total, this is Kerouac, a total understanding of the holy goof. This is what Kerouac calls the vicissitudes of life and what and how we deal with it. He's talking about Neil Cassady. It's the book Visions of Cody. Just breaking into a Three Stooges goofy act. Because his own life is ridiculous and impossible. And this is his answer to it. Well, latest and perhaps really best vision was the vision I had of Cody. That's his name for Neil Cassady in this particular book. One drowsy afternoon in January on the sidewalks of workaday San Francisco, imitating what the Three Stooges are like when they go staggering and kicking each other down the street. We just blasted in the car. As we drove down the hills into wild mid-market traffics and out past Third, past the dingy bars with their incredible names like Moonlight in Colorado or Blue Midnight or Pink Glass, and inside it's all wretched, raw, brown whiskey and mauve boilermakers, past Mission Street, too, with its corner conglomerate of bums, a dragging winos, so torpid that when pretty women pass, they don't even look at the pretty woman. They seem to be too guilty to look at ordinary women, and they come to the rail yards where we were, and crossed the warm, airy plazas of the day, and how in our lives together we were always finding ourselves on a golden, sleepy, beautiful, good afternoon, like the afternoons that must have been experienced by the noble sons of great Homeric warriors after wild nights characterized and charactering across the ghosts and white heroes of phallic classical fate. And just like that, Cody and me, only American, when it comes into Cody's head to imitate the stagger of the Three Stooges. And he did it with wild, crazy yelling on the sidewalk, right there by the arches and by the hurrying executives, his eyes popping in his head, exercising this hard exercise of staggering, his whole frame of clothes capped by those terrible pants with 6-7 holes in them and streaked with baby food and common ice cream and gasoline and ashes. And I saw them spring into being at the side of Cody in the street just then. Mo, the leader, mopish Mowbray, mope, mope mouth, mealy, mad, hankering, making the others quake, whacking Curly on the iron pate, backhanding Larry, who wonders, picks up a sledgehammer, honk, and ramming it down nozzle first on the flat pan of Curly's skull. Boing, and all the big dumb convict Curly can do is muckle and yuckle and squeal, pressing his lips and shaking his old butt like jelly, nodding his jello fists. I and Mo, who looks back at him with that lowered and surly, well, what are you going to do about it? And they do muckle and moan and pull and mop about in an underground hell of their own invention. And Cody was with them, laughing and staggering in savage mimicry of them, bopping one another so much that they'd learned not only how to master the style of the bopping and blowing, but the symbol and the acceptance of them. And then I knew that long ago, when the mist was raw and Cody stood outside a pawn shop or a hardware store in that perennial pool hall outside a pawn shop, yeah, or a door, or maybe under tragic rainy telephone poles, and I thought of the Three Stooges, suddenly realizing life is strange. Three Stooges exist. That in 10,000 years, all of the goofs he felt in him were justified to the outside world. And he had nothing to reproach himself for. Bonk. Boing. Crash. Skiddly-boo. Pow. Slam. Bang. Boom. Wham. Blam. Crack. Frap. Kerplunk. Clatter. Clap. Blap. Fap. Slap. Map. Boing, crack, scrunch, crunch, crouch, boing, splat, splat, boom. That's good. I will do one last poem for you. Summarize that idea of the polishing up that thing inside the soul. This is Allen Ginsberg talking about being at a hungover in a railway yard with Jack Kerouac in there. They just beat, you know, and he sees a sunflower. And Jack Kerouac's just like hungover, and it's like a sunflower. I've never seen one before. But of course, you know, Allen Ginsberg's like ecstatic. It's like a whole transformative, you know, ultimate moment of recognition and vision in his life. Sunflower Sutra. I walked on the banks of the tin can banana dock and sat down under the huge shade of a Southern Pacific locomotive to look at the sunset over the box house hills and cry. Jack Kerouac sat beside me in a busted, rusted iron pole companion. We thought the same thoughts of the soul, bleak, blue, sad-eyed, surrounded by the gnarled steel roots of trees of machinery. The oily water on the river mirrored the red sky. Sun sank on top of final Frisco peaks. No fish in that stream, no hermit in those mounts, just ourselves, roomy-eyed and hungover like old bums on a riverbank, tired and wily. Look at the sunflower, he said. There's a dead gray shadow against the sky. It was as big as a man, sitting dry on top of a pile of ancient sawdust. I rushed up and chanted. It was my first sunflower. Memories of Blake, my visions, Harlem and hells of the eastern rivers, bridges clanking, Joe's greasy sandwiches, dead baby carriages, black treadless tires forgotten and unretreated, the poem of the riverbank, condoms, pots, steels, knives, nothing stainless, only the dank muck and the razor-sharp artifacts passing into the past. and the gray sunflower poised against the sunset, cracking bleakly and dusty with the smut and smog and smoke of old locomotives in its eye. Corolla of bleary spikes pushed down and broken like a battered crown. Seeds falling out of its face. Soon to be toothless, mouth of sunny air. Sun rays obliterated on its hairy head like a dried wire spider web. Leaves sticking out like arms out of the stem. Gestures from the sawdust. Root. Broken pieces of plaster falling out of the black twigs. A dead fly in its ear. Unholy, battered old thing you were, my sunflower. Oh, my soul. I loved you then. The grime was no man's grime, but death in human locomotives. All that dress of dust, that veil of darkened railroad skin, that smog of cheek, that eyelid of black misery, that silly hand of phallus of protuberance of artificial, worse than dirt, industrial, modern, all that civilization spotting your crazy golden crown, and those blear thoughts of death and dusty loveless eyes and ends and withered roots below and the home pile of sand and sawdust and rubber dollar bills and skin and machinery, the guts and innards of the weeping coughing car, the empty, lonely tin cans with their rusty tongues black and alack. What more can I name? And you there stand before me in the sunset, all of your glory in your form. A perfect beauty of a sunflower, a perfect, excellent, lovely sunflower existence, a sweet, natural eye to the new hip moon, woke up, alive, excited, grasping in the sunset shadow, sunrise, golden, monthly breeze. How many flies buzzed around you, innocent of your grime, while you cursed the heavens of the railroad and your flower soul? Poor dead flower. When did you forget you were a flower? When did you look at your skin and decide you're an impotent, dirty old locomotive, the ghost of a locomotive, the specter, the shade of a once powerful, mad American locomotive? You were never no locomotive, sunflower. You were a sunflower. And you, locomotive, you're a locomotive. Forget me not. So I grabbed the skeleton thick sunflower and stuck it at my side like a scepter, and I delivered my sermon to my soul and to Jack's soul too, and to anyone who will listen. We are not our skin of grime. We're not our dread, bleak, dusty, imageless locomotive. We're all beautiful golden sunflowers inside. Imageless. We're blessed by our own seed and golden, hairy, naked accomplishments, bodies growing into mad, black, formal sunflowers in the sunset, spied on by our own eyes under the shadow of the mad locomotive riverbank sunset, frisky, hilly, tin can evening, sit down vision.
Supposed to end at 6, but if anybody has a question, quick question, you come.
I wonder if you could just say something about Whitman's reading, and specifically his reading of the Psalms and of Rousseau and of William Blake.
You know, my understanding of Whitman is, and for the rest of my life will be a work in progress, but, you know, I know that he talks about, and biographers like Reynolds, David Reynolds, talk about his time when he used to go out east to visit his sister, eastern part of Long Island, and she lived on the North Fork of Long Island, that he used to spend many weeks and months in the summertime reading on the beach. And the list of references and the sophistication of it was really quite broad. And yes, including passages from the Bible, the Psalms. I can't tell you specifically, but if you people who can go through and they can pick out and say, this is from, just like, you know, that quote by Tom Joad or by Casey, and, you know, is a quote from the Bible. You know, the two are better than one because, you know, he does that over and over again. You know, it's an important reference for him. Other questions? Yes. Was he popular? Whitman was the P.T. Barnum of poetry. You know, he was a self-promoter. He just did an incredible job of self-promoting. He wrote his own. He wrote reviews of his own work under fictional names, and published them in papers. I mean, yeah, there was that going on. He was desperate for getting blurbs. The 19th century equivalent of blurbs is to send your book, to Ralph Waldo Emerson or to a famous writer and say, tell me you love me. And he waited very impatiently to get that sort of affection back. I mean, he was part of a literary scene. It wasn't just in the newspaper business that he was involved in New York City. You know, there was the first Bohemians in America were underground people at Clapp's Tavern. They had a literary magazine, and they were big supporters of his in that literary magazine. They used to meet them. Clapp's Tavern was in the basement on, I think it was West Broadway. You can still see where it was. It was a German-style bar. And, of course, their idea of Bohemians is very different from, it's changed over the years. But so he was part of a literary group like that. He was very aware of how to make his work known, but also make it stand apart. Because there's a lot of different ideas about what your role could be as a writer. And there's a lot of messianic-type stuff going on, at that point in time. People presenting themselves as visionary philosophical seers for the public. And that's part of what he was doing. Yes. What's the what? What surprises me the most? What surprises me the most? I mean, a lot surprises me, because that's the kind of life I live. The world's surprising. But one of the things that surprises me about Whitman is that he was not an egomaniac. And there's such a temptation to think that he's talking about a song of myself, and he's like taking himself, I'm going to be under your boot soles. People in the future, when you're lying in bed making love to your wife, I'm going to be there between you, right? Those sorts of comments, at first glance, you go like, whoa, who is this guy, He's like a peeping. That's kind of creepy, But he's not that. It's in the philosophical sense. He's talking a lot in the philosophical sense. Him as everything and one thing at the same time, and him as you, and you as her, and all of us as individuals and part of the infinite soul that I mentioned a number of times. So that's what surprised me is how nicely he synthesized all those things into the "quote unquote ego Walt Whitman." Yes, Jim.
Give us examples of kind of parallel, sort of parallels in the explosion of pantheism in the 19th century. And I wonder, what are the origins of that? What was the spirit of the times? For example, did the explosion of Darwinian ideas, of evolution, and did that have an influence? Or
with
an influence of Oriental philosophy as with the
B generation? Well, Whitman, and that first poem I read, I would have loved to just spend an hour reading Whitman, but, you could read one poem by Whitman, it would take you an hour, if you don't extract from it. But, I mean, one of the things is his inclusiveness. He had a real, when he's calling out to people on the islands of the archipelagos of the ocean, and I packed it down to something that takes 3 and 4 minutes. He goes on for like 20 minutes mentioning every country, and Ethiopia and this one and that one. Everything, he can throw everything into the bucket and mentions it. So, I mean, to think that he would have excluded pantheistic thinking, no. This is a guy that was very inclusive. Yeah. Any more? Thank you so much for coming today. I hope you had a good time. I had a good time reading that stuff to you. And enjoy the rest of your day.